It's December 7th, 2017. This is the Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight is the 77th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And we'll present a report on the conditions and events that led up to this day of infamy. Now, this report will be based largely on information from Nicholson Baker's 2008 book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. Now, we'll trace the Pearl Harbor story from 1934 to 1941. Revealing beyond any doubt that Washington knew the attack was coming, where and even when. The attack was used to get us into World War II and lay the foundation for an American socialist dictatorship on the European model, empowered by a military-industrial complex which has ruled Washington ever since the end of the war in 1945. Pearl Harbor was our first great disillusionment, followed by the Kennedy assassination and the Vietnam War and 9/11. Now we need to look back at ourselves and examine the evil that has crept into our republic under the mantle of what has been called democracy. And before I get into this, I want to mention that I'm not trying to excuse either the Japanese Empire or the Nazi government for any of the atrocities and the ruthless activities that they conducted during World War II. I'm not trying to excuse them, but I am interested in pointing out that this evil allowed an equally determined evil to set into in on our side, and World War II was the vehicle in which this evil took its form, and that's what we're trying to establish here. Is the background of the Pearl Harbor attack, and we'll use Nicholson's Baker's book, Human Smoke, to do this. And what he did, he collected a lot of historical anecdotes and newspaper clippings and news from the period to bring this across. This is a very difficult essay for me to deliver. I was raised in an Army family, and following family tradition, eventually became an Army officer myself. I remember December 7th, 1941, vividly. I was 6 years old on that day when a squadron of B-17s from MacDill Army Airfield flew over our house in St. Petersburg, Florida, on their way out to California. The house shook with the vibrations of their engines. And my father said, "We're going to war, son." He was soon to ship out to the Pacific. My uncle was already over there. I spent the war years living with my grandparents in Georgia, and I remember those years well. But I also remember the years before the war. I remember the submarine based in our harbor, the flying boats at our seaplane base, the big silver B-17s over at MacDill, and my father's Springfield rifle, which was as big as a cannon to a little boy of 5 years old. I remember Life magazine in 1940 with a big map of the Pacific Ocean marked with arrows and showing naval and air attacks. And the headline was, "The War We Know We Must Fight." Actually, most of my memories from childhood before the war were of military equipment or activity. I was raised to be a soldier, and as a child, I was fascinated by all things warlike. And, of course, I believed that America was always in the right and that we were the good guys, and the evil Nazis and the ruthless Jacks were the enemy. And, of course, they were evil and ruthless. Both the Nazis and the Japanese militarists were cruel and merciless warriors who committed atrocities and made war on the innocent. They deserved to be contained and even defeated in their own ambitions. But what I and most of the American people did not realize is that we, and especially our leaders, were equally evil and ruthless. The myth that the Allies didn't target civilians or mass murder prisoners or use gas or biological chemical weapons was just that, a myth. The British began the bombing of civilians in Germany years before the London Blitz, which we in America were told was a Nazi atrocity. Our firebombing of Tokyo in 1945, which killed more civilians than both atomic bombs, planned back in 1940. We began challenging the Japanese in the Pacific back in 1934, and we kept up the pressure until they finally responded in 1941, and Roosevelt finally got us into war. And virtually abandoned the Army and the Navy in the Pacific. And, of course, this enabled him and his leftist associates to establish a socialist welfare state government in the United States that was closer to the Nazi model than to the Soviet model. And although most of Roosevelt's associates were more inclined toward the Soviets, but still, the military-industrial complex was on the Nazi model. FDR hated the Nazis, as he called them, but he used their corporate-sponsored socialism scheme, the military-industrial complex, to defeat them. But such a monster needs an enemy, and the Soviet Russia provided us with a Cold War to keep it going after World War II. But they finally succumbed to the economic power of the new global fascists, and a new enemy was needed. Now, in ancient Rome, the emperor would stand up in the Senate and point a spear, like a compass needle, in the direction of the enemy. But where's the enemy now? So let's go back to 1934 with the help of Nicholson's book and trace the origin of our greatest naval defeat through historical evidence. And if you remember in the film Tora, 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 our Secretary of War began reviewing the facts in late 1941 and said,
"A frightening picture is beginning to emerge." Actually, it began to emerge long before 1941. So, let's get into Baker's book. 1934. President Roosevelt was using money from the National Recovery Act, part of the New Deal, to build 32 warships. He visited Pearl Harbor, a naval outpost near Honolulu, Hawaii. Hawaiian singers sang traditional songs for him, and 300 Japanese girls danced by lantern light in a historical pageant at the Iolani Palace. And in a speech, the president praised the richness of Hawaii's past, the cleanness of Hawaii's houses, and the efficiency and spirit of Hawaii's American military forces, of which he was commander-in-chief. These forces must ever be considered an instrument of continuing peace, he said. And he thanked everyone and expressed a wish to return someday. I say to you aloha from the bottom of my heart. It was July 28, 1934. In the Japan Advertiser, General Kunishiga Tanaka, a former military attaché to Washington, wrote a response to President Roosevelt's visit. He said, "President Roosevelt has traveled to Hawaii and there inspected the Pearl Harbor base, which is regarded as the center of American offensive operations in the Pacific." General Tanaka said, "Telling the world in loud tones its equipment is perfect. This event was accomplished," the general noted, "by news of the Navy's League lobbying in favor of vast American fleets.
and by the creation of U.S. air bases in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. Such insolent behavior makes us most suspicious. It makes us think a major disturbance is purposefully being encouraged in the calm Pacific. This is greatly regretted. So, we were squaring off on the Japanese right there in 1934. And then, in 1935, President Roosevelt placed Wake Island, a reef in the Pacific Ocean, under the administration of the U.S. Navy. He granted Pan Am Airways permit to build runways on Wake Island, Midway Island, and Guam. It was 1935. The Japanese military authorities were not pleased. The airports could become military bases, they said. The islands are natural aircraft carriers, affording enemy squadrons ideal places from which to operate, wrote a retired commander-in-chief of the Japanese Navy. Should they be occupied by an enemy, they would endanger our defense. So, what do we do? In 1935, 160 American ships and 450 American airplanes began war games in the Pacific. The largest war games in American history. It was April 1935. The Fellowship of Reconciliation, a peace group, sent an open letter to the people of Japan with a copy to President Roosevelt. We desire to convey to you, the letter said, the knowledge that many thousands of our citizens, especially those who constitute the membership of our churches and synagogues, have protested against the holding of these maneuvers. Japan and the United States had maintained friendly relations for 81 years, the letter said. Multitudes of our people, whether connected with institutions or religion or not, oppose these maneuvers and join us in spirit as we convey to you our assurances of continued and undiminished friendship. Admiral Kanji Kondo, former Japanese chief of staff, said that the American naval manifestation was like drawing a sword before a neighbor's house. Well, that's too damn bad, Admiral Stanley, the chief of naval operations of the United States, said. So, that was 1935, the year I was born, by the way. And going right along, 1935, John Hayes Holmes' anti-war play, If This Be Treason, at a world premiere in Westport, Connecticut. It was July 29, 1935. And in that play, he predicted a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And people were very concerned about this in the United States. And we should remember, of course, that the Japanese Navy had very soundly defeated the Russian Navy in 1904, as you may remember. And so the Japanese Navy was, ever since then, was a force to be reckoned with. And, of course, they were expanding in the Pacific, and we know that. So I guess they're interjecting that in the sequence here because, we were in the Philippines, and we had a presence in the Pacific ourselves, and so consequently, this is not all one-sided. We had our interests there to defend. But regardless of that, this is all leading up, and this is all well known, but the American people don't remember it. And they didn't remember it, it wasn't reflected as we started into this thing. Now, this is the beginning of a plot, a rather dastardly plot, that eventually resulted in the creation of the American volunteer group, the Flying Tigers, but originally it was a dastardly plot. And the dastardly plot was finally carried out in 1945, but it was originated in 1940. Colonel Henry Smith Hutton, the American naval attaché in Tokyo, submitted a report to Washington about Japanese cities. It was September 30th, 1940. Their fire hoses are old, worn, and leaky, Smith Hutton wrote. Water mains are shut off at night. Little pressure is available. Fire hydrants are few and far between. There weren't many bomb shelters, the attaché continued, and because transportation was overcrowded, evacuation would present tremendous difficulties. Incendiary bombs sowed widely over an area of Japanese cities would result in the destruction of the major portions of these cities, Smith Hutton said. A list of important bombing objectives would follow, Smith Hutton promised. That's September 30th, 1940. That's the beginning of this thing, which finally culminated in 1945 with our General LeMay burning down Tokyo and killing more people than move the atom bombs now. This plot, this plot that started in 1940 about burning down Tokyo, it continues, and we'll follow it as it continues. Now, Admiral Richardson, this is 1940. Admiral Richardson, commander of the U.S. fleet, had a confrontation with President Roosevelt. It was October 8, 1940. Richardson said that he'd said in his letter to Admiral Stark and his memo to Secretary Knox that Pearl Harbor was the wrong place for his ships. Roosevelt said he thought that having the fleet in Hawaii had a restraining influence on Japan. Was the United States going to war? Richardson asked the president. He replied, in Richardson's account, that if the Japanese attacked Thailand or the Kra Peninsula or the Dutch East Indies, we would probably not enter the war. That even if they attacked the Philippines, he doubted whether we would enter the war. Now, that's incredible. But the Japanese couldn't always avoid making mistakes, the president said. Sooner or later, they would make a mistake and we would enter the war. By the way, if you remember Tora, Admiral Richardson was turning over command to Admiral Kimmel, and the two of them are flying in, if you remember the scene in the PPY, and they're back in the blister, on the side blister, looking down at the harbor. And Richardson says, my God, you know, he said, look at that. It's a mousetrap. The ships are trapped in there. And Kimmel said, yeah, they are, but Richardson several times and asked the president to move the fleet back to San Diego. Now, that's 1940, all right. And again, 1940, President Roosevelt announced on the radio the opening of the registration for the draft. Calmly, without fear and without hysteria, but with clear determination, we are building guns and planes and tanks and ships and all the other tools which modern defense requires, he said. Today's registration for training and service is the keystone in the arch of national defense. It was October 16th, 1940. So that was a peacetime draft, first time we've ever had a peacetime draft. And so, moving right along, you know, Roosevelt got elected promising to keep us out of war back in the beginning of the Depression. He promising to keep us out of war, and then no sooner did he get into office than he seemed to realize that the only way we were ever going to really get out of the Depression was to get this military-industrial thing going. Okay, so now, 1940, Japan chose a new ambassador to the United States. There are few, if any, Japanese who want war with the United States, Admiral Kishimoto Nomura said as he left Tokyo. Now, Nomura really did want peace, and he was a former admiral. And he said before he left Tokyo, "The fate of the world hangs on American actions just now. If the United States becomes involved in a conflict either in Europe or in the Pacific, civilization will go up in flames." It was November 26, 1940. Nomura was our friend, as those of you who have seen Tora, you know, Nomura is very well depicted in there. It was Kusura, who the Japanese said later, who was the war hawk. Now here we go with the bomb plot again. Roosevelt asked Henry Morgenthau, the Treasury Secretary, to loan China $100 million to help the nationalist government keep fighting against the Japanese. The money would go for airplanes. Claire Leatherface Chennault ghost wrote a four-page memo to Roosevelt from Chiang Kai-shek proposing a special air unit operated in China by pilots and crew members from the United States. Chiang Kai-shek's wealthy emissary and brother-in-law, T.V. Sung, delivered the memo to Morgenthau, who read it. It was November 30th, 1940. Now, this is the beginning of the Flying Tigers. But here's what the memo said. "There are 136 airfields available in China," Chiang Kai-shek's memo said, "more than half of which are in excellent condition and all serviceable for both bombers and pursuits. Several of these airfields are within 650 miles from Japan. The new special air unit could," Chiang said, "work in concert with the Chinese Army, or it could operate independently by striking Japan proper. Maps showing the location of airfields could be provided." Morgenthau thought about the airfields and their proximity to Japan. He sounded out Lord Lothian, the British ambassador. Morgenthau told Lothian he was going to try to get four-engine bombers and crews to the Chinese, with the understanding that these bombers are to be used to bomb Tokyo and other big cities. Lothian seemed agreeable. "It might change everything," Lothian said. Now, so the British got themselves involved in this thing, too. Now, what actually happened, as we're going to find out as we go through this, the idea was to send B-17s over there to China within range of Tokyo, and with American pilots and American bombardiers and put Chinese insignias on these planes and fly them over there and firebomb Tokyo and cause, you know, massive civilian destruction. Something we skipped over here is that we were following a British doctrine on bombing. The British, back in the 1920s, the British started bombing villages in Africa and India, recalcitrant native villages, from the air. If they wouldn't pay their taxes or they threw their local police constabulary out, then the British, then the RAF would fly over and bomb the village. And so they started this whole idea, this began this idea of bombing civilians. And it was started by the British and adopted by the Italians in Ethiopia and by the Germans in the Spanish Civil War. And unfortunately, it even got into an Army Air Corps manual. This business that civilians are a valid military target for aerial bombing. And so, the Japanese, of course, were bombing Chinese cities using the same, the same tactics, bombing civilians, and that this was the justification for us sending the Flying Tigers over there, you know, this is Roosevelt's justification for, and Morgenthau and the rest of them for cooking up this scheme to firebomb Tokyo. All right. Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, had lunch with President Roosevelt. Then he had a talk with T.B. Soong. It was December 8, 1940. Morgenthau swore Soong to secrecy and then brought up the equipping of China to bomb Tokyo and other cities. To say he was enthusiastic is putting it mildly, Morgenthau wrote in his diary. I told him that I had not discussed this with the president, but intimated that it was the president's idea, which it is in part because he has mentioned it to me that it would be a nice thing if the Chinese would bomb Japan. Morgenthau brought up the airfields, the ones that were within 650 miles of Tokyo. Could Soong furnish some information on them? The next day, Soong sent a handwritten note in connection with General Chiang Kai-shek's secret memorandum to the president confirming China's air needs. I take the pleasure of enclosing a map of China showing you the location of the airfields now in the possession of our Air Force, which I hope will prove of interest. There was a P.S. This map is, of course, very secret, and it's for your personal information. Now, actually, we did start to send the B-17s over there. We sent a squadron to India, but it never went to China because the Chinese communists had that area up there near Japan, and they couldn't be dealt with. There were problems in that regard, and so the whole plan devolved to the point where General Marshall, chief of staff, vetoed it. He vetoed the plan, and that's what. Well, and the plan turned into the ABG, the Flying Tigers, which were American soldiers of fortune pilots who were sent to first to Burma and then up to China. And they were used primarily to shoot down Japanese bombers that were bombing Chinese cities. So that's how this thing finally turned out. So the Flying Tigers, of course, were considered great heroes and they were. They really were a very romantic bunch of guys. And very early in the war, we needed some heroes in this country. Okay, this is December 1940. Dr. Soong was in Henry Morgenthau's dining room when Claire Chennault planning the firebombing of Japan. It was December 21st, 1940. Chennault said that each plane would need an American bombardier and an American pilot, plus five American mechanics, and Morgenthau said he could manage to have enlisted men released from active duty in the U.S. Army Air Corps, assuming the men would be paid a good salary, $1,000 per month, said Soong. And Chennault discoursed the range of different bombers. The Hudson bomber could fly 1,000 miles with a good load. That's ridiculous. Since it was 1,200 miles to Tokyo and back, the Hudson couldn't bomb Tokyo. However, Nagasaki, Kobe, and Osaka were within range of the Hudson bomber. The Hudson, however, was not a bomber. It was a Lockheed Lodestar that somebody stuck a gun turret on and put it in, cut a bomb bay in the bottom. He said the flying fortresses could reach Tokyo, but there were two Chinese fields with long runways that the fortresses needed. Could the planes fly at night? Morgenthau asked. Yes, said Chennault. They'd have to fly at night because the fighter escorts they needed for daylight missions didn't have enough range to make it to Japan. And what about incendiary bombs, Morgenthau asked, inasmuch as the Japanese cities were all made of just wood and paper. Oh, a lot of damage could be done that way, they all agreed, and then they said goodbye and went to bed. But, of course, as I said, they ran into problems with those runways, and because the communists really had that area, they couldn't do it, and they had to send B-40s over there instead of B-17s. Undersecretary of State, well, let's get on through to this right here is one of the most significant things in the book here. January 24th, 1941. In Tokyo, the American ambassador to Japan heard something about a possible surprise attack.
There is a lot of talk around town to the effect that the Japanese, in case of a break with the United States, are planning to go all out in a surprise mass attack at Pearl Harbor, the ambassador, Joseph Grew, wrote in his diary. Of course, I have informed my government. I wrote down here, great God Almighty, in the book here. Here it is, January 24th, 1941, a year before the attack. And by the way, although he doesn't mention it here in the book, Baker doesn't mention it, the Japanese had even written a book about how they were going to attack Pearl Harbor, and it was written by a young naval lieutenant who was a member of the Black Dragon Society. I have a copy of that book, and they had laid out the whole plan for the attack and everything else. It wasn't exactly Genda's plan, but it was pretty close to it. I'm sure Genda followed it as main outline, but. Yet this book was circulating in private circles around, secret circles around Japan. And the Korean spies sneaked it out and got a copy of the United States. So we knew all about this. And this was you know, about a year before the attack. We knew they were going to do it. Now, I got a thing about Lend-Lease here. We started Lend-Lease around this time to Britain, which, of course, Roosevelt called us the arsenal of democracy, you know, at that time. Okay, so here we go. We're still on the bombing plot. And this is July 23rd, 1941. The Joint Army-Navy Board of the United States approved a plan called JB-355. It proposed an expansion of the Air Force in China so that it would be able to carry out, among other things, the incendiary bombing of Japan. The plan was drawn up by Roosevelt's economist and China expert, Lucian Carey. A front corporation, China Defense Supplies, formed by T.V. Sung and run by Roosevelt's former aide, Thomas Cochran, was to buy the planes from American manufacturers. Claire Chennault would hire and train American volunteer pilots to fly the planes. The pilots were to be paid through further front corporation, Central Aircraft Manufacturing Corporation, or CAMCO. This was a surrogate of Curtis Wright, by the way. Roosevelt read the joint board plan, okayed it. Lucian Carey wired Madam Shanghai Shack and Krishnov that a letter that fairly begged for interception by Japanese spies. I am very happy to be able to report that today the president directed 66 bombers to be made available to China this year, with 24 to be delivered immediately. Also approved a Chinese pilot training program, details through normal channels. Japanese intelligence agents relayed detailed reports of the airplane sale and the training program back to Tokyo. American intelligence agents then intercepted and decoded these Japanese reports, tracking the progress and other provocations. Actually, the Flying Tigers got over there in Burma and started training, but they didn't really get into combat until after Pearl Harbor. This is, for some reason we seem to think they were in combat, and the Japanese, just because they were over there, the Japanese were complaining about it, obviously, but they didn't really fire a shot in anger until after Pearl Harbor, and then they did quite well. Now, this is where we really get down to it, the oil embargo. President Roosevelt was in the White House talking to the Volunteer Coordinator Committee, War Preparedness Group, July 24th, 1941. This is July, of course, you know, and in December it happens. Sandbags may be necessary in certain parts of the country, he said, and we need to get the right information out. There's a lot of things that people don't quite understand, he said. For example, why
Am I asked to curtail my consumption of gasoline when I read in the papers that thousands of tons of gasoline are going out from Los Angeles West Coast to Japan? Well, the answer is very simple, said the president. If we cut off their oil, they probably would have to go down to the Dutch East Indies and a year ago, and we would have had a war, Kelly explained. But it's very essential from our own selfish point of view of defense to prevent a war from starting in the South Pacific. So our foreign policy was trying to stop a war from breaking out there. Our foreign policy was, Roosevelt had used in the past tense. Now, what this all means, and it sounds like double talk, what he means is, if we had cut off selling oil and gas to the Japanese, then they would have had to invade the Dutch East Indies to get their oil and their gasoline. And by not doing that, by selling it to them, we could avoid having a war. So we continued to sell it to them. But Roosevelt finally decided at this point to stop it and institute the, very shortly thereafter, institute the oil embargo. And the oil embargo, of course, is what literally launched the Japanese into the taking of the Pacific Rim. They had to take Indonesia to get their oil. They can't run a navy and an army in China and everything. They had to have oil. So they had to attack Indonesia. We forced them. We literally forced them by doing that to invade Indonesia. They needed the Royal Dutch Shell and all that, and they needed that oil. And of course, the Philippines were naturally, well, the American Army in the Philippines were standing right in their way. So we set this whole thing up for them and left them hanging, and then the oil embargo. July 1941, an executive order emanated from Hyde Park. It was July 25th, 1941. In view of the unlimited national emergency declared by the president, he has today issued an executive order freezing Japanese assets in the same manner in which assets of various European countries were frozen in June 14th, 1941. A joint Anglo-American oil embargo followed. So, we have now, if you remember from both Tora, Tora, Tora and this more recent Pearl Harbor movie, the Japanese were talking about, oh, well, our oil's been cut off. We have no choice. Well, that was it. Now, Charles Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy, who flew the first flight across the Atlantic, Charles Lindbergh really didn't want us to get in the war. He was a colonel in the Air Force, and he didn't want us to go. He'd gone over and visited the Nazis, and he looked at the Luftwaffe and the Air Force, and he thought we should just leave this thing alone. We weren't ready to take these people on at all, and Lindbergh became a pacifist. He was trying to keep us out of war, and so he made a speech. And I think this is important to read. Charles Lindbergh gave a speech in Des Moines at the America First rally. It was September 11th, 1941. Lindbergh said that agitators had worked together to involve the United States in the war in Europe. They planned, first, to prepare the United States for foreign war under the guise of American defense, and second, to involve us in the war step by step without our realization. Third, to create a series of incidents which would force us into the actual conflict. There were, Lindbergh said, three groups of war agitators, the British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration. He could understand, he said, why the Jews wanted the Nazi government defeated. And we quote, no person with a sense of dignity can condone the persecution of the Jewish race in Germany. But no person of honesty and vision can look on their pro-war policy here today without seeing the dangers involved in such a policy, both for us and for them. Instead of agitating for war, the Jewish groups in this country should be opposing it in every possible way, for they will be among the first to feel its consequences. Tolerance is a virtue that depends upon peace and strength. History shows that it cannot survive war and devastations. A few far-sighted Jewish people realize this and stand opposed to intervention, but the majority still do not. And then Lindbergh said their greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government. Now, what he's referring to here is as far as our entertainment is concerned, is the German film industry was just about run over here by the Nazis. They all came over here and got into Hollywood, which was referred to as Weimar on the Pacific for a while. Now, Lindbergh was booed and cheered in turns, and someone in the balcony threw a package of American First handouts at him as he spoke, and he missed and knocked over a plant. Now, Lindbergh, of course, when the war started, Lindbergh was vilified as a traitor and everything else by a lot of these people who would call the left wing liberals, they all turned on him as a traitor and everything. Lindbergh had meanwhile resigned his commission in the Air Force, but he went over as a consultant to the Pacific, and helped to redesign America's most effective long-range fighter plane, which didn't have that when the Lockheed P-38, which was a twin-engine fighter plane that we had, that was one of our secret weapons during the war, it had a very deficient range. And Lindbergh was an expert at designing aircraft, for maximum fuel capacity. So he redesigned the P-38 and flew it himself, and even in combat, and got doubled the range on the P-38 and made it one of the most effective weapons that we had during the war. And so Lindbergh redeemed himself in that respect. He redeemed himself as far as the armed services are concerned. Now, September 1941, British headquarters in the Far East sent General Douglas MacArthur a how-to memo, The Problem of Defeating Japan. It was September 19th, 1941. And so the British were down in Singapore, and Singapore was as powerful a base as Pearl Harbor, and it was devastated just like Pearl Harbor. And so we're moving steadily along toward this situation. Now, October 4th, President Roosevelt began gradually leaking the news of his new war plan, the Victory Program. $100 billion would go to the building of 125,000 airplanes. Half of the entire productive capacity of the United States would be devoted to the production of arms. Tanks and what are described as unbelievable numbers are planned. They were lousy tanks, though. The New York Times reported, Eugene Duffield, the head of the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau, pondered the meaning of that many tanks, and he wrote a long story the next day. By its emphasis on tanks and ordnance, the Victory Program reveals that long-range bombing and ocean blockade are no longer counted on to subdue Germany, Duffield wrote. The program, he said, envisioned an American army composed of one of every three men between the ages of 18 and 45. Now, in October 18th, 1941, all Jewish immigration from Germany was officially shut off by edict. Now, what does that tell you? We literally sacrificed the German Jews. And you know, this is one of the reasons. The one reason, by the way, David, this is the one criticism of this book that I was able to find, the one bad review, is that it doesn't promote the myth that we fought World War II to save the Jews. We did not. We sacrificed them. And let's see. That's the one bad review that I was able to find on this book, because it became really obvious as you read through it that we sacrificed the German Jews. Definitely, we have many, many chances we had to take them to in this country, or to take, you know. Interesting, that's the same thing here with people trying to get the Syrian refugees into this country, and we don't want to take them. All right. Now, the New York Times Magazine section carried an article about the fanatic, gloomy Japanese. Tokyo was grim and thought controlled, said the paper. Dance clubs were closed. Spies, secret police, and German officers were everywhere. The elevators, the flights were off to save power. Taxis ran on charcoal gas. There were some pictures accompanying the article. One showed a row of women passing a bucket of water while their drill leader talked to them through a megaphone. And the caption was, "Bucket Brigade, Japanese women trained in firefighting." Another picture was of a group of men operating a hose. "Air raid drill in Tokyo," said the caption. It was October 26, 1941. Yeah, Lindbergh speech again, but I'm going to skip that one over. Now, our ambassador, Gru, over in Tokyo, gives us his last warning on November 3rd, 1941. In Tokyo, Ambassador Joseph Gru sent a long telegram to the State Department, hoping someone there would heed it. Washington's imposition of severe economic sanctions might force Japan to risk national hari-kari, Gru warned. An armed conflict with the United States may come with dangerous and dramatic suddenness. And this was November 3, 1941. In his diary the next day, Gru wrote, "If war should occur, I hope that history will not overlook that telegram." Of course it did. Now, General Marshall leaked the bomber plot. Roosevelt's Army Chief of Staff, George Marshall, had some reporters from Time, Newsweek, Times, and the Herald Tribune, and three wire services into his office for a briefing. "We are preparing an offensive war against Japan," Marshall said. He told the reporters about the Chinese air bases, and he said that there were 35 B-17s in the Philippines with more on the way. Shuttle bombing from the Philippines to Vladivostok was under consideration. The aim was to blanket the whole area with air power. "Now keep this secret," he said. It was November 15th, 1941. Keep it secret, for heaven's sake. But as I said, they never could get this firebombing plot off the ground until 1945, after we had bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki with atomic bombs. Then we finally did the firebombing. And what LeMay did, he used B-29s, of course, not B-17s. He circled around. They just did a big circle around Tokyo and started all these fires in a circle. And then they went back and forth across the circle like cutting up a pizza pie and started these lines of fire. And they literally made a gigantic roasting pizza pie out of Tokyo. And, of course, you know, they killed half a million people. It made the atomic bomb, you know. It was like, all right, well, if the atomic bomb didn't kill enough of you, we'll go back to the original plan. Now, the last hope. A member of the Japanese parliament, Gyuji Kasai, said,
There were no problems between the United States and Japan that cannot be settled by peaceful diplomacy. It was November 28, 1941. And the next day, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein of New York's West Side Institutional Synagogue offered a prayer for the political representatives of the United States and Japan. May they be conscious, Rabbi Goldstein said, of the awful sacrifice in life, blood, and security that must be offered if hostilities between the two nations ensue. The big leak came on December 4th. Someone leaked the full text of Roosevelt's victory program to a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And the Tribune and its sister paper, the Washington Times-Herald, both anti-Roosevelt and isolationist, huge headlines appeared. FDR's war plans. Goal is 10 million armed men, half to fight in the American Expeditionary Force. This was, we knew that it was leaked out. We were definitely going to go to war, whether the American people wanted it or not. And the news made the late edition on December 4th, 1941. A headline in a Japanese paper said, "Secret United States plans against Japan and Germany are exposed." Now, this was December 4th. And, of course, on December 7th, they hit. Now, I think we've just about brought us up here to the, in the Baker book, I think we just about brought us up to the, to the day of infamy. And I think that this will give you, those of you who still blame our, who are still blaming our losses on that poor lieutenant in the control center, when he got the, when the boys up at Kona Point called in the radar sighting of the Japanese, and he says, don't worry about it, must be, they, and then he turns around and says, the boys must have picked up those B-17s coming in from the land, from San Diego. No, they were, don't blame him, and don't blame the Navy captain when the destroyer Ward sunk the little Japanese mini sub coming in the harbor and reported it, and this Navy captain on watch ignored it and asked for confirmation, and hey, don't blame him either. The reason why these guys were so complacent, and why they were just, because nobody in the Pearl Harbor military knew what was going on. They didn't know, and they'd had so many drills, and they'd had so many false reports that they were just they were. Sort of in a state of, not again, all this stuff. So we don't, trying to blame what happened on Admiral Kimmel or General Short or any of those boys that saw the Japs coming or anything like that, you can't do that. You got to blame it on Roosevelt and his gang, because they knew in Washington, this was the inner circle knew, not the boys in the Pentagon. They didn't know, and Marshall didn't even know. It was all what we're now calling the deep state. They knew. They knew when, where, how, and exactly what. And they had, and interestingly enough, the Japanese hit when all of our aircraft carriers were out on patrol. There was not a single aircraft carrier in the harbor. So what they ended up doing was sinking a bunch of obsolete battleships
Of course, unfortunately, a lot of boys drowned in those battleships when they were sunk. And Zandre and I have been out there and, you know, walked over the Arizona. You know, you can look down in the water and see where those boys are entombed down there, and it's pretty sad. And then they had found a memorial to my submarine that I had crawled all over as a kid, you know, and it got sunk in Manila Bay, you know. So there was, going to Pearl Harbor was really quite a very memorable experience. And that's just one of the reasons why I'm doing this show tonight, because nowhere on television, if you look at your TV guide, you won't see Tora, Tora, Tora. And you won't even see that new film, Pearl Harbor, which exonerates Roosevelt. That film, Pearl Harbor, is an attempt to make a hero out of Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was not a hero. I hope you realize after this, what we read in Baker's book, Roosevelt, you know, he set this whole thing up, and he knew it was going to happen, and. And he suppressed the news of it for weeks. For weeks, he wouldn't allow the American people to know how bad it was. So anyway, this was our Pearl Harbor show, and I hope the next time you see Tora, 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 and you should watch it every December 7th. Realize, like as I say, don't blame what happened on any of the boys. And one another thing to think about: if they really had known, if Short and Kimmel had known, then the P-40 was not a dog of an airplane. It was actually a better fighter plane than the Zero, And that's the truth. And as young Lieutenants Taylor and Welch, later generals, proved in the skies over Pearl Harbor, and they shot down about seven Japanese planes, including Zeros. The problem with the Zero was they had 20-millimeter cannons that were so slow that one Zero pilot said trying to shoot an American plane with one of those 20-millimeter cannons was like trying to hit a dragonfly with a rifle. And the Zeros were okay for strafing ships and strafing vehicles on the ground, but they weren't much good for aerial combat. And the P-40s, if we had gotten, we lost about the 200 P-40s on the ground, if we'd gotten them up, and met the Japanese before they got to the harbor, we would have decimated them. And as Taylor and Welch proved, and that again, you can see that dogfight with them in Tora, 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 and of course it's glamorized in the Pearl Harbor movie. Anyway, this is our Pearl Harbor Day show, and next week we'll be back we'll be back, you know, doing our hermetic magical work. And so until next week, good magic, and remember Pearl Harbor.